Bill, this is hard on all of us. It's no time for compliments. But I think it's extraordinary of you to come down here for this.
Well, if we're not here for one another during the tough times, we're not a news organization.
Well, you've certainly got character, boy. Not much intelligence, perhaps, or any instinct for newspaper work, but character you got up to here.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
Oh, we got some character. Joni Balter is a news analyst. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Knut Berger is the Mossback at Crosscut.com and an author. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, D.
C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox News. Merry Christmas.
Same to you.
We're going to talk about the year in news, but holiday traditions? What do you do for Christmas, Joni Balter?
Okay, so we drink, we sit around, drink massive amounts of coffee, open gifts, and then sort of work it all out with a run around Seward Park.
The whole family.
The whole family, except for one who prefers the stairs.
So three quarters of the family.
There you go.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
What do you guys do?
The family always gets together. The one thing that's always present, regardless of whose house we gather at, is the Danish tea ring from Larson Brothers Bakery. It just wouldn't be Christmas without that wonderful almond paste smell.
I think that should be mandatory for most households.
I was going to say, that's an advertisement, too. It wouldn't be Christmas.
Well, it's it's great. And it's always fun to go out to Larson Brothers, right? Because you want the tea ring fairly fresh, right? So you go out there, you know, a few days before Christmas. It's in Loyal Heights in Ballard, you know, and it's always a madhouse.
Really?
Scandinavian madhouse.
Such as it is.
People are fighting over krumkaka and fatiman, you know, all the great delights.
CR's was the most
We did talk about this a little bit before we went on. I've done this for about 3 or 4 years. So my brother and sister live here with their 6 kids combined, and they get together at my place. And for about 3 years, I've done this family history quiz. So I do about 15 questions. And it's sort of a fun way, you know, I want these kids to kind of know about their family. And so, you know, my parents, their grandparents, I ask, you know, where was their honeymoon? How much did they pay for the first house? You know, just fun factoids.
See,
and then they get lottery tickets.
They get lottery
if
tickets.
If they win. Top three.
Incentive.
Top three get lottery tickets. So it's a fun way to, you know, convey the family history.
I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, I like it too. I like the way it's sort of CR's combining Christmas and City Club.
Yeah.
Oh, and game show.
It's a civic event. It's a civic event.
And gambling for children.
And gambling.
And gambling for children.
It works. I recommend the tradition. Start it in your family and start the fun.
We celebrate Christmas too, but you mocked me for my Christmas Eve celebratory. You said it was a cliche, but I couldn't help it. I like it. We've gone to a good Chinese restaurant or Japanese, Korean or whatever. In the ID or other places, and then a fine movie.
And that is perfectly reasonable. The only part was it was a little bit of a cliche.
For Jewish
people always do that.
Yeah. My sister, I asked her what she was going to do for Christmas because she wasn't sure she was going to come to the family thing. And she said, we're doing Jewish Christmas.
See what I mean? This is what I'm talking about here. Okay.
Well, the next day I took a, you know, the turducken that people always talk about?
Oh, yeah.
I just thought, I want to understand this dish, but I did not do a turducken. I did a chicken breast, and then a duck breast, and then a quail breast.
They were just separate, right?
No, they were all wrapped together.
I was going to say, they're fitting together. Each other in like those Russian dolls.
Yeah,
kind of
fit them all together and sewed them up. And
wow, that sounds good.
It was good, but I didn't. Chiduckale?
Did you have to spit buckshot out of the quail? It's not quite game bird unless you have to spit the buckshot out.
We're getting close to Duck Dynasty here.
Oh! Is that your top story of the year, right?
No.
Top story of the year, Duck Dynasty.
You wouldn't dare.
You did a City Club event where you reviewed the news of the year. What and you had Rob McKenna, you had Tim Egan, you had Susan Delbeny mm-hmm. as your panelists.
Also had the head of Virginia Mason.
And the head of Virginia Mason.
So who broke news at this event?
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
What was the news he broke?
Well, you wouldn't expect the guy at Virginia Mason to be endorsing single payer, and he all but did.
All but sort of inadvertently.
I see.
And before you said there's the news flash of the year, I said, oh, there's news out of this event.
So it was a little bit surprising for him to say, hey, you know, the solution to all this, and I'm in the middle of it, he said, is probably single payer, and we probably need to get there somewhere. I mean, a lot of discussion revolved around Obamacare and health care because that was a big part of this year. I think it is the biggest story of the year. And that was a panel about, you know, the year in review.
And in some ways, it was just more an acknowledgement that one of the problems with Obamacare, you know, it has its virtues, whatever they are, but it's so complicated. It was sort of like, well, if it's going to be this complicated, perhaps maybe.
I ran into a health policy analyst who argued that, indeed, that was the chess-playing five moves of President Obama. That was his intention by 2016 or so.
Oh, there you go.
Not going to happen.
No way.
No way.
Single payer.
No way.
The forces against it will unite.
They're just too strong. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though they're doing all they can this whole year to show its inadequacies, Obamacare?
It doesn't need a lot of help at the moment. So,
well, I mean, half of the population really is under single payer, right? I mean, half of the population or some
Medicaid.
Maybe not quite half, but, you know, Medicaid, Medicare, VA. I mean, those are kind of our version of single payer. And interestingly enough, that is the part of the system that is working best. It's the kind of private insurance market, especially for younger people, that, you know, ends up not working. You don't get enough enrolled. You don't get enough coverage. That's where 47 million people are.
What has it meant for in your analysis, the three of you, what has it meant that it has been the troubled rollout that it has been? Not for Obama in this case, but for the nation.
Well, so one thing that I wrote down when we were assigned to come up with these stories of the year and things that were, you know, had such a big
impact. We do have assignments, by the way.
We do have assignments.
And, you know, you are graded.
I just broke it. But one of the things that I was thinking about, and we've talked about this, is how fast the news is revolving. So you have, you know, the who's up, who's down, Democrats, Republicans, Obama versus Congress, and all this stuff. And what I was struck by this year so much was that at one point we were all talking about Syria, and then the next minute we had all forgotten about Syria, and we were talking about those darn Republicans in the shutdown. And then about 2 seconds after that, for another swing of the pendulum, it was how bad Obama and the Democrats were for backing this mess known as Obamacare. And so political fortunes, if we're looking ahead to 2014 or beyond, kept swinging, and they're still. It's just moving so quickly.
Does that seem different than other years to you, what Joni's saying?
It feels like every year the cycle's getting faster, and the news is old, you know, within an hour. but I do believe the lingering story basically all year long was Obamacare. I mean, listen, this was the year of implementation. This is when all kinds of stuff kicked in for this thing. It was the discussion from Obama all year long. It was what the government shutdown was about. You now have the botched rollout and all the ramifications of that, not just for, you know, the people who are trying to get health care, but for the president and credibility and all the rest. So I find it hard to find another story that dominated the news like that one did this year.
Does Obamacare rise to the top in terms of the fiasco that it may have been this year for you?
I think it's a major story. I think it's I also think it's a major story that isn't going to go away in a flash because of the way it's implemented. And you know, when something goes from theory to reality, and it's a reality that virtually affects everyone in the country, people will find something to be unhappy about. You know, we know that the rollout has not gone smoothly. It's revealed how confusing it is, and even people like myself who support Obamacare, you find something to be irritated about. You know, I had a thing this week where I found out that because of compliance considerations with the new Health Care Act, group health changed the way it deducts my premium from my account, and it moved it up 2 weeks. So I've got to have $1,000 a month or 2 weeks before I get paid it. You know,
well, you know, that's the thing.
It's a small thing. It's a small thing, and I'm glad to have the insurance and all that, but it's irritating.
So there are those annoyances. So people who had full health care find out they don't have, they can pay the same amount, but they don't have dental. But there is a flip side of this. I mean, this is the end of the year story that it was messed up. But there are features of Obamacare, and I'm not entirely sticking up for it, but there are features that people are going to get hooked on, like kids staying on their parents' health care till they're 26, like you can't be excluded for a pre-existing condition. Who's going to want to roll the clock back on that kind of stuff?
Well, right. Those are the kinds of things that make it, I think, impossible to repeal. And at least in the current setup, it could be repealed in another, but it's perilous. And I think even a lot of Republicans realize that would be perilous. It's also the reason that I have hope that eventually it will lead to a single-payer system, will lead to something simpler. I doubt that would be in 2 years, but I think over time, and I think that was one of the reasons the Republicans wanted to kill it in the cradle, because they're worried that once an entitlement gets established, to the degree that it is an entitlement, it's very hard to get rid of. But I think it will have to be simplified.
Well, on Meet the Press, I saw Patty Murray on there, and she was actually there with Paul, you know, there to speak about the work she'd done on the budget with Paul Ryan. But somehow David Gregory took it over to Ye Olde Healthcare, and she was ready and had this answer that was, you know, that she had run into somebody, Mrs. Hoosie Bops or whatever, who had not had health care before, was finally going to be covered, and how that kind of, you know, story over and over again made her very happy that she was an advocate for health care. And so that's some of that people who have found a piece of Obamacare that they like and won't let go is perhaps the story for next year, but we'll see. They have to clean up their mess first.
It will continue to be this story, not just because it affects so many people, but because the credibility of the president has now basically suffered so much. I mean, this sort of pull cliff he fell off of because of this disastrous rollout and his sort of famous line that, you know, you'll keep your health care if you like it, you'll keep your doctors if you like it. That is a tough thing to recover from. That's the toughest thing to come back from. So he's going to suffer other losses and other setbacks because he's politically damaged on the healthcare front.
But I'm going to hold you guys there because next week, that's what we're going to talk about as we look forward. But I just want to say that isn't it interesting that you could use a phrase like compliance considerations? We've all become experts in healthcare this year.
Yeah, we're using the jargon.
In the pieces of it.
I just want to say, though, that I think that while some of the deficiencies of the rollout were self-inflicted, sabotage has also gone on here by the Republicans. And what I mean by that is that Obama has asked Congress again and again to help him improve the Health Care Act before the rollout, and if he had a Congress that was committed to fixing it. And I go back, and we talked about this before, to the rollout of the New Deal early in Franklin Roosevelt's. It was a disaster. It was a mess. Roosevelt was criticized. A bunch of his programs were eliminated. I mean, it was not a smooth rollout. Did the New Deal help America? Yes, it did, and it was something that had to be perfected and improved over time. And I think that we were talking about how quick the news cycles are. Part of it is that relatively small difficulties that affect a really relatively small percentage of people have in the Obamacare thing been blown up as if they're some kind of catastrophe. And, you know, I think there's a way in which these, whether it's the New Deal or the new healthcare thing, you're in kind of almost a war mode, in the sense that you're trying to do something for the greater good that is going to be imperfect in its execution. And I think people need to be more patient, but that is not the media world that we live in. The reality is very different, and I hope Obama responds to that.
I just wanted to add here that we have to remember that the rollout of Obamacare is very much state-by-state experience. And so even though Washington was on a great list of the top three and then sort of had some troubles, but the gist of this is some states are doing better than others on this, and one of the most amazing stories is how poorly Oregon is doing. And it is very much state-by-state. And, you know, you'll find a surprise, like Kentucky is doing really well. So it is localized as well.
All right, the rollout of Obamacare. We're looking back on the year 2013. I might cycle back to that idea of news cycle before the show is over, because that tells us something too. Will, how have you been affected by Obamacare and its rollout? And is that the big story for you? Why don't you shoot us an email, weekinreview@kuow.org. I'd like to see what you're thinking about, what the big story is, and whether it's Obamacare. This is the Week in Review from KUOW.
42 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. We're expecting some rain this afternoon and a high today of 48. Then it's going to be a dry weekend, partly sunny days, temperatures in the mid-40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Chihuly Garden and Glass, celebrating New Year's Eve with a party in the exhibition's glass house at Seattle Center with live music, dancing, and an up-close view of the Space Needle's fireworks. Tickets and more information at newyears@chihuly.com.
It's 1023, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Little Joe Strummer there for you on the Week in Review from KUOW. I'm Steve Scherr with C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, Joni Balter. We're taking a look at the big stories of this past year. King 5 went down to listen to some machinists when they were debating, this just a few days ago, whether and how they would vote on the contract offer that Boeing has put before them. Here's what a couple of machinists said.
Right now, this would pass. That's why they don't want to put it out.
We want something to happen. We have to work together. We're stepping on our own toes because we're making ourselves look divided when we're not.
A couple of machinists thinking about what this is going to mean. There's so much in this story. And I guess I want to start with the idea of what impact it's had on the workforce itself. You all have had some chance to think about it and talk to the machinists, and we've talked this last few weeks about what it's meant, what their obligation is or not. What do you think about how this story is affecting the people that are working?
Well, there was an interesting comment in the clip that you just played that talked about how this would pass. Now, don't forget, that is quite a change from just a few weeks ago when the Boeing contract offer, which has now changed a bit, but went down 2-1 by a margin. And that is what I've been wondering about the whole time. Everyone is talking about them and not giving them until next week their chance to vote. And clearly, if it affects their lives this much and if it affects the whole region this much, the second offer, you know, we can argue all day whether it's changed enough or not changed enough, but clearly it should go to the rank and file and give them a chance to say what they want their future to be. So it's good that there is a vote. There's some debate about if that's the right day because many of them are still on vacation and all of that. But it is good that the vote is coming because it's you know, some of them have changed their mind about how they will vote.
I think the workers have been pretty bold. I mean, they basically have been betting on the bluff, and they were right. I mean, 2/3 of them turned down that contract, not because they thought jobs were going to go elsewhere, but because they thought Boeing would come back with a better offer. And indeed, the company did. I mean, it sweetened sort of all the pots that are talked about in this deal, except the retirement pension pot. And the question now is the machinists' union still going to bet on the bluff? I mean, do they feel like this is the final thing Boeing's going to do, or will they move again on those pensions? And I just don't know how it's going to come out. I mean, you're certainly going to get fewer people rejecting this offer. So if it goes down, it's not going to go down by 2/3. But, you know, it could pass. The deal may be good enough for the machinist at this point.
Well, maybe I shouldn't read so much into that idea of them being bold and going for the bluff. But what do you make of the fact that the working people in Boeing did do that? That was their action first time around it.
Well, I agree with CR. I thought it was gutsy. They have a better read on the situation. They've been through these things before. They know, often these negotiations are conducted in private. In this case, it's all kind of out there for everyone to see. I do think that it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a perception that Boeing has been somewhat successful in dividing the union in terms of the national leadership and the local leadership. And anytime you get union people disagreeing with each other, that's an advantage for management. it doesn't necessarily guarantee a particular outcome, but the whole concept of a union is solidarity. So if you can put a crack in the solidarity, that always helps. Then you have a rigorous kind of internal debate. What none of it does is change the well-established template/dynamic in place, which is that even if the union votes to go ahead with Boeing's offer, if a state transportation plan is passed, we're still stuck in a situation where we are expending vast quantities of our public resources to support a hugely profitable company, where many of those, most of the profits are benefiting somebody else.
Well, I think the telling moment, of course, was that they did come back to talk to Washington workers. They came back, so that showed a little bit that you could push them a little bit. However to quantify that, but push them nonetheless. And these workers here are emboldened by the fact that they were sort of the rescuers of the 787. And whenever a plane is having troubles, you have a workforce here saying, we're the fixers. So we will fix again and you will not have the same problems. And Boeing seemed to recognize that by another pass at the table, correct?
I mean, part of what's going on here is that the workers are assuming that the costs of going elsewhere are higher than we all think. I mean, it's not that easy to up and start from scratch a new assembly of an airplane in another state. I mean, you have to do all kinds of infrastructure building. You have to create this labor force out of nothing. And we saw the downside of that in this move to Charleston, South Carolina, where the 787 line went, one of the lines, where not only – and that's part of the problem with the 787 delivery, not the only problem, but was the Charleston backup. And that had to do with a ramping up a skilled labor force very quickly. But the side effect was that there was a drain on the skill force here. It took them shipping some of the best people here to South Carolina to ramp those skill sets up. So you sacrificed your home office for that. So there is this benefit to the synergy of having this all done in a region that has years a building and infrastructure, an education infrastructure, a freight infrastructure, a supplier infrastructure to create these things. And to do that anew in another place is expensive. It's not just labor costs.
Can I posit a thesis? First, I'll read what Ralph Nader had to say, because Ralph Nader weighed in on this, and this goes to my thesis. A book could be written about the Boeing Company's strategy for externalization of a variety of its costs onto innocent, defensive people, defensively. He has a little problem there.
We could innocent use people. An editor.
Yeah, whether workers or taxpayers. Boeing's systemic campaigns for corporate welfare are shameful. Your company, he's writing to Washington State citizens, your company is one of the major corporate welfare kings in America, running a close race with the champion, General Electric. So here's my, I posit this thesis because it plays into some of the larger questions that I want to get to. Did this action by the union, and did the response by other municipalities where workers sort of wondered whether they were going to be engaged in a race to the bottom fighting each other, did we see a shift towards instead maybe a slight resurgence of worker solidarity, or even perhaps a broader view of where workers sit in this economy.
Well, since that's been building nationwide in various working sectors, of course there was a little bit of that in there.
Just a little, though, huh?
There was some of that in there. Yes, it seemed to me for sure that there was that. I also thought there was this sort of Northwest defiance. You know, we're going to make our stand and we're going to let the chips fall where they fall in that original vote. But now there's obviously, you know, so it seems like both sides are rethinking where they were, because Boeing's back to the table, more on the table, and the workers are saying, in your own clip, we might say yeah, but narrowly probably, but we might say yeah.
But we heard from Inslee, you just said it, that a trained and educated workforce is going to be, and we hear it from Obama, we hear it in the world. You know, the trained and educated workforce is the place where we begin to rebuild and strengthen our economy. So is there a new energy among workers that might translate into different kinds of actions?
Well, if Boeing stays here and this new 777X is built here, this will be a big win for labor. This will be a huge win for labor in a two decade, three decade really decline for organized labor. So, you know, a little step forward and kind of a large and a large sort of tide going out for them. Because if these jobs go elsewhere, they will go to right-to-work states. They will go to places where, you know, you'll have some union membership, but you won't have near the union membership that if this thing is built here.
One of the interesting dynamics is that the established unions and the unions that have the where the workers have worked their way up to these living wage jobs, and you can look at this as the unions that work for the Port of Seattle or for Boeing and whatnot. These are the areas that management is attacking in order to knock those high-paid jobs down. The place where the energy seems to be on the organizing side are among the lower paid workers. This is the $15 an hour movement. This is the SEIU level, where there's a lot of action and a lot of organizing. So there's this simultaneous, this battle going on, which is to get the people at the low end unionized or get their wages increased and moved up. At the same time, there's a real battle against the established and moving those jobs to right to work states. That's a huge economic dynamic.
Well, that also
very hard for one union in one location to fight.
Unless it's linked. That's what I'm wondering. Is it linked? Is the $15 an hour minimum wage mentally, if nothing else, linked to the defiance that the Boeing workers rose up against?
Well, because they are not $15 an hour workers. They are workers who are more trained, and they're saying, "Don't come after us and take too much back."
Right,
is what they're saying.
but the unions see the $15 an hour movement as very important. They're very supportive of it, and at least locally, they certainly are. But also nationally, it's seen as a union organizing tool to kind of, you know, help regenerate.
Well, I think we've also answered one question here as well, and that is, so why is the national more supportive of the contract? Why? Because if this thing goes to right-to-work state or states, what's going to happen to their membership? They lose a ton of power by that, correct? So that's, you know, so everyone's, why is the national in one place and the local leadership in another place? It's very simple. It has to do with what power would remain for the national union.
Hmm. Well, here's what President Obama spent a lot of time this year talking about, that wealth gap. Here's one thing he had to say about it.
In fact, statistics show not only that our levels of income inequality rank near countries like Jamaica and Argentina, but that it is harder today for a child born here in America to improve her station in life than it is for children in most of our wealthy allies, countries like Canada or Germany or France. They have greater mobility than we do, not less.
People have been arguing for a while that fact, as it emerges, is going to redefine politics over the next few years? Do you did and that's why I'm you know, Shama Sawant in the Northwest, other socialists seeing her victory and saying maybe we have some leeway here. Is this is the beginning of a movement?
It certainly feels that way around these parts because we know our city council is probably going to go along. There was a stat, and I can't quote the number because I don't remember it, but there was a stat that talked about the difference in pay between the top level and then the worker bees, and whatever that number is, it's huge. It has so increased in recent years that it sort of explains that if there's going to be a movement, this is partly what it's about.
Obviously, inequality is getting a lot of press and it's getting a lot of attention, both locally and nationally. And there's a bit of a fight within the Democratic Party about what to focus on, whether we should focus on inequality, whether that should be sort of the primary, you know, thing we attack, or if it's still about unemployment and jobs. They are related but separate. I mean, you could attack inequality and sort of take down the 1% several notches and still have high unemployment, still have medium income that stagnates. So there is kind of a division about whether you should focus on getting more jobs, a lot of stimulus spending, a lot of infrastructure, worry about the bottom as opposed to kind of worrying about bringing the top down.
Well, I think the income disparities and level of that are really crucial to deal with. But another issue is mobility. In other words, the ability of people at the lower end to get to the middle, the ability of the people in the middle to improve their lot and move higher. And, you know, so it requires a whole range of, you know, policies. This has been recognized as an issue for decades now. Bill Clinton ran on the forgotten middle class. And that whole campaign strategy about focusing on middle class values had to do with the fact that that most people who are not in the middle class think of themselves as in the middle class. In other words, rhetorically, when you talk about the middle class, it includes a lot of working class people who have those aspirations. They don't want to see themselves as poor. They don't want to see themselves as needy or whatever. And so you have to the income distribution system of the market and taxation and whatnot has to fuel an expanding of the middle class and a decreasing of that disparity, and that money can go to infrastructure and other job-making things. But you also need policies that encourage new things, innovation. And I think there's a I think it's a huge problem. I think the middle class, the American middle class, is what gives us, I think, a stable society in many respects.
Well, one thing I noticed looking back at the year was that the economy is not the thing that people talk about in the way that they did a year ago. In the way that they did a year ago or maybe 2 years ago, jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what everybody said. So now it's not so much jobs, jobs, jobs. It's what are those jobs paying and what's a fair amount for those to pay. So perhaps we could call that progress.
I was just wondering, is a narrative emerging? And that's what Obama has tried to create, a narrative that other people will use in the years ahead. But, you know, you can link health care, these efforts, the $15 minimum wage, this widening wealth gap, to one way or another, as you're saying, what that narrative is going to be to tell that story.
Listen, inequality is expanding. There's no doubt about it. It's been exploding is not too strong a way to describe it since the 80s. But you also have had a lot of progressivism put into the tax code recently. I mean, arguably, we have a more progressive tax code than we've had since Jimmy Carter. I mean, you have high marginal rates now. We've upped the capital gains rate. We've upped the dividend rate. We now have a surcharge for Obamacare, a medical health surcharge on high-income earners. So a lot happened just in 2013, the beginning of the year, with the sort of rollback of the Bush tax cuts. So we've gotten a lot more progressive. The best thing for median income is a tighter labor market. I mean, the best way to sort of get wages up is to have lower unemployment and have workers be in the bargaining position, not companies. When you have low unemployment, wow, companies can extract all kinds of things because workers are scared. Workers don't have the power. So having a much, much smaller unemployment pool, a tighter labor force, will bring up wages a lot.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about the other big stories, including the NSA leaks by Edward Snowden and their impact. This is The Week in Review on KUOW.
It's 43 degrees in Seattle. We've got a good chance of rain in the forecast for this afternoon, and we expect to get up to 48 degrees. Overnight, we're looking at clouds with a chance of rain, a low of 38. And then Saturday and Sunday, both looking partly sunny, maybe some patchy fog, and daytime highs in the mid-40s.
Hi, it's David Green here. Every day, KUOW and NPR weave together intelligent reporting and thoughtful analysis to bring you programs that are tailored for the Seattle area communities. Your support makes everything you hear on KUOW possible from year to year. You might have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your tax-deductible gift before December 31st, or you can go online at KUOW.org, and we thank you.
We got a few emails from you about the news of the year discussions from Hans. National, a tie between Obamacare's implementation and the president finally growing a set and facing down the obstructionist Republicans over the budget and health care. Macro local, Boeing ongoing battle with machinists. It's possible for the company to make billions and treat its worker fairly. Will it ever happen? Don't hold your breath. Micro local, coal ports here in Whatcom County. Will a grassroots effort win over big business and what is best for our land? And Annie writes, what's next? No children, no spouse, nowhere to go. When is someone going to address the population of women who are over 45 to 60 losing unemployment benefits? Next week, 401k gone. And Gloria, Nicolette says, can we talk about what people who are stuck in the crosshairs of Obamacare are supposed to do? We have kids. We can't go without insurance. But after being covered for almost a lifetime, we're considering just dropping our coverage. We're self-employed and not caught under the umbrella of a huge company. Are we the only family that doesn't know what to do and what our resources are? No, there's a lot of people. And then Don writes, it's the economy, stupid, the stock market, unemployment. All indicators are at records. Are these not important in 2013? Well, I think that goes to your point, right? About
yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Because it's easier, because the economy is better somewhat for a lot of people. The underlying problems are maybe we're addressing them more now as opposed to ignoring them.
Well, yeah.
All right, the other big story that I think is fascinating. A federal judge today, as a matter of fact, came out and in opposition to the federal judge yesterday, said that the NSA data collection system is constitutional and is legal. Edward Snowden, the leaker of the NSA documents, came out with a Christmas Day message. And here's part of what he had to say.
Think about what this means for the privacy of the average person. A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought. And that's a problem, because privacy matters. Privacy is what allows us to determine who we are and who we want to be.
What about that? Privacy well, matters.
I think it goes to show you how full of himself Edward Snowden can be at times.
Oh, touche.
that you could never have a private thought again. I mean, of course, it's ridiculous. I mean, Snowden has done partly a service and partly a disservice. I mean, obviously exposing some things and showing and calling our attention to what the government's doing, but going ridiculously overboard and dumping too much in the process. But I think it's a huge issue and it's not going away and all politicians are going to have to deal with this.
Well, one thing I've noticed about all of this is this sort of each person has sort of made their pact with the fact that there is all this data. And so one thing I've been struck by is how many people say, go ahead, listen in on my phone calls or listen in, read all my emails. You know, go ahead and data collectors. It's just not that interesting. And so there's this sort of way that individuals are sort of settling up with this new reality that has come in. And I saw on that City Club panel Rob McKenna talking about sort of what we gain from the sort of the security, the 9/11 perspective on this as well. So that's the other side of it.
That's, of course, what the judge said today.
Well, yes. It's interesting because the real concern, and I think Edward Snowden is speaking to this, is what happens when you put together a national security state as extensive, as far-reaching as the one that's been constructed. And even if you believe that President Obama wouldn't misuse it or Congress has oversight, well, clearly we've discovered in this process that Congress doesn't really know what's going on. The people that are supposed to know don't know. The judges have not been challenged on some of these issues, so we don't know the extent of the what's going on or the constitutionality of some of it. And that's starting to get played out now. But also, there you have to think down the road, and I think this is very hard to do when you put the country on a kind of a permanent war footing, as George W. Bush did, which is what happens when we elect somebody who's not reluctant or less reluctant or even enthusiastic about using the system. We know from our experience with both the CIA and the FBI that abuses happen. And so you have to put in safeguards. You have to put in – I don't think anybody would argue that we shouldn't be conducting some level of surveillance and espionage on people that we think are our enemies. But who our enemies are is something that can get redefined in ways that have to be checked. And I think the notion of what privacy is, and this, you know, NSA aside, is something that's been evolving and is going to have to change anyway. I mean, you can see in human behavior with Twitter, with cell phones, with the intrusive nature of the media into personal lives, that the idea of what privacy is has changed and evolved.
And think about how much of that submission, as you're suggesting there, that submission to this information being available is voluntary. I mean, anybody with a Google email, that is being reviewed privately. This is not the NSA that's doing that. And then we all benefit as well from some of the security things that are in place. One of the big stories of the year, of course, was the Boston bombing during the marathon. And how did they settle that one and find the folks? It was on surveillance cameras, right?
Yeah. Of course, they weren't able to prevent it.
That too.
Some people argue that they didn't have enough data.
They didn't have enough data.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to cycle back to something that I left out, and it may even fit in here, which is in terms of that discussion about the wealth gap, and maybe in terms of the discussion about how we view each other as individuals in this technological world. What has Pope Francis meant this year? Because I think Pope Francis is, Time Magazine and I both think, Pope Francis has been a really interesting character.
Well, if you want to talk about transformational figures and people whose impact is felt around the world, you have to end up with Pope Francis, and you think about how he has changed attitudes toward religion, toward tolerance, so, you know, with his comments on marriage equality. You know, he had a really – if you think about this quote, it's fascinating. He says, who am I to judge? Well, you're the Pope, but let's proceed, you know, and as well how we talk and think about the poor. I mean, he's had a huge impact worldwide.
I mean, in terms of the income inequality, I mean, he went from being, he inherited the pontiff from a pope who was into being policemen, to becoming Francis the Pope, who's into poverty combat. I mean, that's going to be his mission. It's really a uniter. I mean, to get you out of these divisive sort of social issues that's mired the church. Everyone can kind of agree on poverty combat. And I think this
to a point,
much more universal than trying to agree on abortion or birth control or something. the other thing about it, it's not just his you know, pontificating, if you will, about poverty, but it is his lifestyle. I mean, he is ostentatiously austere. I mean, this guy, you know, doesn't wear red. He eschews the ruby slippers of Benedict. He doesn't live in the papal apartments. He paid his own hotel bill when he was there for the conclave. He's out there taking pictures with cell phones, you know, with kids in St. Peter's Square. He's inviting the homeless in for you know, Christmas Eve or something. He is so of the people and so remarkably different, especially from Benedict, that symbolism just shows an emphasis on the poor and on helping those who are underprivileged, and that goes to the inequality thing.
I guess for me, one of the larger questions, and I guess why I'm raising it, is a few years ago, the question was, how powerful is the Tea Party going to be and their politics? And, gee, the 99% movement doesn't have a theme. It's disjointed. It doesn't have anything going on. And yet it seems that you could point to the Pope, these other things have coalesced a little bit. And there is a narrative emerging.
Well, it's interesting when somebody at the height of power atop a hierarchy that's as wealthy as the Catholic Church begins to preach to his own people. I mean, I don't mean Catholics at large, although that's part of it, but to the own this power structure that put him in that position. You know, I think that's what's to me really fascinating is that kind of internal rejection, that internal critique of the institution as it's been manifest. And I think that is the example that goes beyond the boundaries of the church. That goes, you know, to other people in positions of power. It's when you, I mean, this is on a completely different scale, but when a Warren Buffett decides to give his fortune to charity and ask other billionaires to do the same as Bill Gates and others are doing, I think that that's a really, you know, a resonant, really important to see that kind of thing, that there are limits. There are behaviors that are too far and corrupting.
Hmm. Well, one person can change the tone of how we talk about these things. And he has shown that. And that's why he's all over those magazines, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a hunger for that. I mean, think about the funeral of Mandela, too, in terms of the power of one individual to change a global conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's to a lot of Americans, the tone change feels like baby steps. I mean, whether it be his sort of discussion of women or same-sex marriage, that kind of thing, that the culture is farther ahead of him in America. But to so much of the developing world, where, you know, gay people are imprisoned, women have their genitals mutilated. I mean, you know, it's a different world out there in places where Catholicism is big, in Africa. I mean, when you talk about just a sort of tone change on women, on gays and lesbians, that has a huge effect in places that are significantly far behind the kind of developing West when we talk about social issues.
We're talking about the news of this past year with C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox, Kenneth Berger, the Mossback columnist at Crosscut.com, and Joni Balter, news analyst. All right, tone change.
Okay.
Very serious. Now we're going to be – I'm sure we'll still be serious, but it's always good to let somebody just – so Luke Burbank. Oh. Go ahead, Luke. See if you can go
that
from
is a tone
the
change.
Pope and the seriousness of things to what your top story was this year.
You know, I think that my top story was that so many of the quote-unquote viral stories were completely fake this year, you know, and a lot of this stuff kind of got started or at least picked up a lot of steam on Facebook, which I call the suburbs of the internet, where you just had people. Let me give you guys a rundown of some of the stories that you probably saw people posting on Facebook, which were totally fake. The fact that it snowed on the pyramids, which was supposed to be some kind of indicator of climate change. That New Jersey waitress who got no tip and the anti-gay message on her bill. The guy who got in a Twitter fight or got in a fight with a woman on Thanksgiving Day on an airplane and tweeted it. The twerk fail video. These were all things that were posted on the internet that got millions of clicks that all turned out to be fake. And it felt to me like this year anytime there was a story that started to move around the internet really quickly, I just, something in my gut said, this is probably going to be a hoax. And it seemed like about 70% of the time this year, it was a hoax.
Luke Burbank is host of the podcast TBTL and host of LiveWire that's on KOW on Friday nights. You know, that takes us back to that notion of how fast the news cycle is and
exactly.
how the news cycle is responding to it.
Yes, but I'm thinking Luke is hanging out in the suburbs himself because how else would
Absolutely.
He know? How
well,
else
listen,
would
I mean,
he
I'm,
know?
I'm not above any of this. I mean, the websites that really profit off this are, you know, like BuzzFeed and Gawker and Uproxx and Upworthy. These are all websites that I get most of my stuff from for my podcast.
Well, there you go.
I'm not above it at all. But and the thing is, you know, they get the clicks coming and going because first they post the story that's probably wrong, and then they get to post the story about how the story was wrong, and they get the clicks then too.
And then don't forget the whole sort of side thing, off-ramp of all that is all the people who have destroyed their careers with silly tweets.
For some reason.
What about that?
For some reason, that model that Luke, you just talked about, reminds me of the Boz selling the anti-Boz T-shirts in Denver or whatever. He gets it both ways, you know.
Well, is that because that the news cycle can be both is so quick and also so easily manipulated? So you relied on your gut, Luke. But how do you know those of us who don't have the gut? How do we even deal with all? How are we dealing with that stuff in the years to come?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe it should be like buying a gun. It should be a waiting period. Before you
post rent a gun
on Facebook.
Well, that's,
you know,
a good idea.
Give it at least 24 hours
to see if it holds.
24-hour delay.
I mean, that would sure work for a lot of the all news networks if they waited a little bit because they got strapped.
I just wonder, too, though, like, what is I mean, maybe this has always been inside us, or maybe the internet is helping bring it out, but what is going on with us that we're all just looking for that story that we can be outraged about, that we can post to Facebook and say, OMG. I mean, it's like we're so hungry for that now as a society that's, you know, what gives us stuff so much momentum.
Yeah. And that
so
might
we're hooked on that momentum.
Yeah,
we're hooked on the rapid pace.
There are a lot of talk radio shows that what they do, those producers, for the hour before you go on, I mean, you're just scanning the internet for the craziest, wildest, just far out thing, hopefully with sound, that you could put on the air. I mean, that's what a lot of the media has come to.
We're going to start doing that in the new year. All right,
yeah,
Luke.
Steve, that's how you guys prep this show, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Luke, and it's worked. Luke Burbank is host of LiveWire. That's on tonight on KOW. Luke, thank you.
Sure, thanks, guys.
C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. Knute Berger, Mossback at crosscut.com. Joni Balter, news analyst. We're going to take all these stories up, and next week we're going to sort of see how they take us into 2014. Week in Review is produced by Jason Pagano. Amina Al-Saadi directed the show today. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. Ann Kane helps us produce the show as well. I'm Steve Scherr.